I want you to picture your morning commute for a second. Maybe you drive over a massive steel suspension bridge, or maybe you work in a high-rise office building that's framed with thousands of tons of structural steel. You trust that steel. You trust that it's not going to suddenly snap under pressure. And that immense trust you have, it relies almost entirely on the integrity of welds.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we look at a welded joint and we just see a solid, continuous piece of metal, right? We assume it's structurally pure. But zooming in on a microscopic level reveals a completely different reality.
Yeah, it is a fundamentally chaotic environment down there. I mean, welds are not just pure, clean, perfect metal.
Oh,
They're
right.
actually riddled with impurities, these microscopic bits of debris that we call inclusions. And the microscopic physics governing how these tiny particles behave, well, they basically dictate the ultimate strength or the catastrophic failure of the macro structures we rely on every day.
Which is wild. So our mission for this deep dive is to explore the surprising hidden mechanisms behind those particles. And to do this, we are pulling from a really dense, highly technical metallurgical study from 1988. It's titled The Non-Uniform Distribution of Inclusions in Low-Alloy Steel Weld Deposits.
Yes.
And it's by researchers A.A.B. Sugden and H.K.D.H. Padatia.
Yeah, and it is a foundational paper in the field of metallurgy.
Yeah.
Because the authors aren't just looking at the metal itself,
Yeah.
they're looking at the flaws inside the metal.
The imperfections.
Exactly. And figuring out how to predict and control that chaos in engineering, it completely shifts how you think about material strength and failure.
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to start with the fundamental paradox at the heart of this paper. What exactly are these inclusions doing inside a steel joint?
So, to really understand an inclusion, we have to look at the process of manual metal arc welding itself.
Okay.
When a welder strikes an arc, they are generating temperatures well over 3,000 degrees Celsius, so they're creating this violent, boiling pool of liquid metal.
Like miniature lava.
Pretty much, yeah. And because liquid steel is highly reactive, it will immediately pull in oxygen and nitrogen from the surrounding air.
Which is bad, right?
Very bad. It would severely weaken the joint. So to prevent this, welding electrodes are coated in protective materials. Fluxes, slag-forming compounds, deoxidizers, they basically act as a chemical shield.
Got it. But because it's such a violent, turbulent process in there, tiny bits of those protective materials, like these oxides and pieces of slag, they inevitably get swallowed up by the molten steel.
Yes, and that is the origin of the inclusions. They are trapped, non-metallic particles that are just suspended in the steel matrix.
Okay.
And historically, the conventional wisdom in engineering viewed them as a massive liability.
Why? Just because they aren't steel?
Basically,
Yeah.
because an inclusion is chemically and mechanically different from the surrounding steel, it doesn't expand, contract, or handle physical stress the same way the steel does. So it acts as a stress concentrator. If a microscopic fracture is going to initiate in a weld, it almost always starts at the boundary of one of these non-metallic inclusions. So the old logic dictated that engineers should just try to eliminate them entirely.
Right. But the paper makes it clear that you can't just get rid of them. I mean, it's a double-edged sword because those same dangerous impurities are actually required to build the strongest possible weld.
Yeah, this is where metallurgical engineering becomes this really delicate balancing act. While inclusions can act as fracture initiation points, they're also critically necessary to nucleate, or essentially seed, a highly desirable phase of steel called acicular ferrite.
Okay, acicular ferrite. So as the liquid metal cools, the iron and carbon atoms arrange themselves into specific crystalline patterns, right, which metallurgists call phases.
Right.
And acicular ferrite is one of those patterns.
And it is an incredibly tough pattern. If you look under an electron microscope, acicular ferrite looks chaotic. It forms as this dense, interwoven basket weave of microscopic steel plates pointing in every possible direction.
But wait. Why does a messy, chaotic crystal structure translate to a stronger bridge or skyscraper? You'd think a perfectly organized, grid would be stronger.
You would think so. But it comes down to how the material absorbs energy when it's stressed.
Okay.
If a crack begins to propagate through a highly organized, straight-line crystal structure, there's nothing to stop it. The crack just unzips straight through the lattice, and the metal snaps cleanly.
Ouch.
Yeah. But if a crack hits the messy, interwoven structure of acicular ferrite, it is forced to constantly change direction. It has to zig and zag around those interwoven plates.
Oh, I see.
Metallurgists call this taking a tortuous path. and forcing the crack to navigate that microscopic maze absorbs massive amounts of mechanical energy, which stops the crack from spreading.
You know, it's just like mixing concrete.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if your coarse gravel clumps together in one spot or like pools at the edges of your forms, it creates a massive weak point where the concrete slab will just crumble and crack under pressure.
Right.
But if you can get that coarse gravel distributed perfectly, locked directly into the center of the mixture, it acts as an anchor. It forces the cement paste to bind tightly around it in all directions, giving the whole slab immense structural strength.
Exactly. The underlying principle is nearly identical. The particles themselves aren't inherently the problem. The issue is how the surrounding structural matrix is forced to interact with them.
Wow. Okay.
In the case of our weld, those tough acicular ferrite plates vastly prefer to grow directly off the surface of the non-metallic inclusions. The inclusions are the necessary seeds for the strength we want.
So because these inclusions are both dangerous crack starters and necessary strength builders, the ultimate factor determining whether a weld holds up a building or snaps in half isn't just how many inclusions are floating around.
No.
It's exactly where those microscopic bits of gravel end up.
Precisely.
Which leads to the core discovery of Sugden and Padescu's work.
Right. And to appreciate the weight of their discovery, we have to look at the prevailing assumption in the field before 1988.
Okay, what was it?
Well, because these tiny inclusions are caught in a violently turbulent pool of liquid metal, engineers assumed they ended up randomly distributed throughout the final solid weld.
Just totally random.
Yeah, it was thought to be a complete roll of the dice, a chaotic distribution you simply couldn't control.
But Sugden and Padescu proved that assumption false. The distribution is actually highly structured and non-uniform.
Yes, they established a definitive, observable rule, the rule of the first phase.
The first phase.
They discovered that inclusions preferentially gather at the boundaries of the very first solid phase to crystallize out of the molten pool.
Okay, wait a second. Isn't welding just like melting metal and watching it freeze? I mean, why does it matter what freezes first? Doesn't it all just freeze into a solid chunk of steel?
I mean, it feels intuitive to think of it like an ice cube freezing, sure. But molten alloy cools through a sequence of distinct architectural shifts.
Okay.
As the temperature drops from 3,000 degrees Celsius, the iron and carbon atoms don't just lock into their final room temperature structure immediately. No. Depending on the exact chemical makeup of the weld, specifically the carbon content, they transition through different temporary crystalline structures.
Oh, so the metal essentially shapeshifts through different atomic blueprints while it cools.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here is that the authors found that these tiny inclusions act almost like microscopic markers for that very first blueprint.
Markers?
Yeah. In some chemical compositions, the very first atomic structure to crystallize out of the liquid is a phase called delta ferrite. In other compositions, the first structure to form is called austenite.
Okay.
Whichever crystal structure decides to grow first, the growing solid grains physically push the inclusions out to their expanding edges. So the inclusions heavily decorate the boundaries of whatever that initial phase happens to be.
Man, if the first phase strictly dictates where the impurities are swept, that changes the entire engineering approach.
Oh, completely.
Because if you can manipulate the chemistry of your welding rod to force a specific phase to form first, you can effectively steer the inclusions. You aren't rolling the dice anymore.
And that is exactly the hypothesis they set out to rigorously test. They wanted to prove that by controlling the chemistry, they could control the microgeography of the inclusions.
To see this in action, we really need to look at their experimental setup, because the scale they are working at requires some intense chemistry. I mean, these inclusions are tiny, right? Maybe 1 to 3 micrometers across.
Very tiny, yeah.
So to visualize them, the researchers used a scanning electron microscope. But looking at steel under a microscope just looks like a flat gray plane.
Right.
So to make the inclusions stand out, they used a deep etching technique with a highly aggressive solution of bromine in methanol.
Yeah, the bromine methanol solution is a brilliant choice because it's highly selective.
How so?
Well, it aggressively attacks and dissolves the iron matrix itself, literally eating away the steel. However, it leaves the non-metallic oxides and slag the inclusions completely untouched.
So they essentially dissolve the surrounding steel landscape to leave the non-metallic rocks sitting starkly on the surface. So with this visualization method ready, they set up a tail of two welds using manual metal arc welding to test the first phase theory. Let's look at weld one, which represents the austenite problem.
Right. So for weld one, they struck an arc using a standard low-carbon electrode onto an 11-millimeter thick base plate of high-carbon steel.
Okay.
The extreme heat of the arc causes the metal from the electrode to deeply intermix with the metal from the base plate. And because the base plate was so rich in carbon, the resulting molten pool had a relatively high overall carbon content.
Which means what for the phases?
Well, in steel metallurgy, higher carbon content means the very first phase to solidify from the melt is primary austenite.
Ah. And following the rule of the first phase, as those austenite grains crystallize and grow in the liquid, they should act like brooms, sweeping the inclusions to their outer edges.
Right. And when they etched weld one and placed it under the electron microscope, the visual evidence was undeniable. The large inclusions were heavily clustered in dense chains along the boundaries of those prior austenite grains.
Oh.
And from a structural engineering perspective, this specific distribution is disastrous.
Wait, is it disastrous just because they are clumped together? Or is there something fundamentally wrong with having impurities sitting on an austenite boundary specifically?
I mean, the clumping is bad, but the real danger lies in what happens next at those boundaries.
Okay.
The metal is still incredibly hot and continues to cool. As the temperature drops further, the solid metal undergoes another phase transformation. Those austenite grain boundaries, which are now absolutely littered with large inclusions, become the perfect nucleation sites for a totally different, highly undesirable phase called allotriomorphic ferrite.
Allotriomorphic ferrite. Okay. We established that acicular ferrite is the tough basket weave structure we want. What makes allotriomorphic ferrite so weak?
It basically comes down to its geometry. Instead of forming an interwoven maze that stops cracks, allotriomorphic ferrite forms as long, continuous, wacky veins that run perfectly parallel along the grain boundaries.
Oh, that sounds bad.
It is a soft, brittle pathway. If a crack initiates at one of those large inclusions clustered on the boundary, it doesn't have to zigzag. It just unzips straight down the continuous vein of allotriomorphic ferrite.
It just shatters.
Yeah, the weld essentially shatters along those boundary lines.
Right.
Furthermore, because the inclusions are all stuck on the extreme edges of the grains, they are completely unavailable to seed the tough acicular ferrite inside the core of the grain where we actually need it. Weld 1 is structurally highly vulnerable.
So if high carbon dictates an austenite first phase, which leads to this disastrous boundary vein weakness, I mean, the obvious structural fix is just to lower the carbon, right? Did they try that?
They did. That was the design for Weld 2, which we call the Delta Ferrite solution. They used an experimental medium carbon electrode, but this time they deposited it onto a very low carbon base plate.
I assume they also needed a way to stop the base plate from contaminating the chemistry of the weld pool this time. The paper mentions they used a specific 3-2-1 layer sequence. I imagine that's building up a buffer zone.
Your deduction is spot on. They welded three overlapping beads directly onto the base plate, then two beads on top of those, and finally one single bead on the very top.
Nice!
And they only etched and analyzed that topmost bead. By building it up vertically, they minimized dilution. That top bead was almost purely the metal from the experimental electrode, entirely uncontaminated by the carbon from the base plate below.
So they successfully isolated the chemistry. And because the carbon content was strictly controlled and kept relatively low, the very first phase to solidify from the molten pool was primary delta ferrite, not austenite.
Exactly. And just as the rule predicted, the growing delta ferrite grains swept the inclusions outward. The inclusions gathered densely along the delta ferrite boundaries.
But wait, if the inclusions are just stuck on the edges of the delta ferrite grains, aren't we back at square one? Like they are still sitting on a boundary line.
This is where we have to look at the mechanics of a solid state transformation. This is one of the most counterintuitive phenomena in metallurgy.
Okay, I'm ready.
As Weld 2 continues to cool, it does not remain delta ferrite. Even though the metal is now completely solid, the thermal energy dropping causes the iron atoms to physically rearrange their crystalline architecture.
While it's solid.
While it's solid. The lattice shifts from the body-centered cubic structure of delta ferrite into the face-centered cubic structure of austenite.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because when those new austenite grains start growing through the solid metal, they don't respect the old property lines, do they? They don't perfectly overlap the old delta ferrite boundary.
No, they completely override them.
No.
The new austenite grains nucleate and grow right across the old delta ferrite structure. And because the new boundaries diverge entirely from the old ones, those original delta ferrite boundaries where all the inclusions were parked suddenly find themselves swallowed up.
That's incredible.
They are no longer on the edge of anything. They are perfectly positioned dead center inside the newly formed austenite grains.
It's like the inclusions got pushed to the edge of the room, and then the walls of the room were completely redrawn around them.
Yes.
And because they are now trapped deep inside the green cores, they are isolated from the brittle allotriomorphic ferrite that forms on the new outer edges. Instead, they sit in the center, perfectly positioned to do exactly what we want. They act as seeds, nucleating the tough, interlocking acicular ferrite right in the heart of the metal.
By understanding the atomic physics of the phase transformation, they engineered a scenario where the inclusions became structural assets rather than liabilities. They manipulated the sequence of events to park the impurities exactly where they were needed.
It is such a brilliant deduction, but honestly, it brings up a massive physical question about how these tiny particles are moving in the first place.
Right.
We keep talking about these inclusions being swept or pushed to the boundaries of the growing crystals, but how is that physically happening? We are talking about microscopic particles inside a pool of boiling liquid metal that is freezing incredibly fast. Why don't these tiny particles just float to the surface of the molten pool like bubbles in a glass of soda? If they are lighter than the dense liquid steel, shouldn't they just escape into the air before the metal freezes?
That is the flotation problem.
Yeah.
And it is a vital question, because if they just float away, the entire boundary distribution theory falls apart.
Exactly.
The authors address this directly, using a principle of fluid dynamics called Stokes' Law.
Let's look at the math on this, because the physical realities of the weld pool are staggering.
Stokes' Law allows us to calculate the terminal velocity of an ascending sphere in this case, an inclusion flowing upward based on its radius, its density relative to the liquid, and the dynamic viscosity of the liquid steel.
Okay.
The authors ran the numbers for these specific conditions. They looked at a typical small inclusion, roughly 1 micrometer in diameter. According to Stokes' Law, that tiny particle will float upward through the molten steel at a speed of about 0.5 micrometers per second.
0.5 micrometers per second is agonizingly slow.
Very slow.
And the complication is that a manual metal arc weld cools incredibly fast. The paper points out that any given spot in the molten pool remains liquid for maybe 5 seconds before it freezes solid.
Right. So if a particle is rising at 0.5 micrometers per second, and it only has 5 seconds of liquid time, it is only going to travel about 2.5 micrometers upward.
Which is nothing.
It hasn't moved at all in any practical macroscopic sense. Meanwhile, the solid freezing front, the physical wall of solidifying metal advancing through the liquid pool, is moving at roughly 2 millimeters per second.
Wait, the freezing front is moving at 2 millimeters per second, and the particle is floating at 0.5 micrometers per second. The solid wall is moving thousands of times faster than the particle can rise.
Yeah. The inclusions simply do not have the time to escape to the surface. They are completely engulfed, swallowed whole by the rapidly advancing solid metal. Flotation is entirely negligible.
So if they are essentially stationary compared to this massive, fast-moving wall of solid steel, and they can't float away, how do they end up at the grain boundaries? Why wouldn't the fast-moving wall just freeze over them instantly, trapping them perfectly randomly wherever they happen to be sitting?
Well, the paper outlines two primary physical mechanisms that explain this non-random movement. And both occur right at that intense microscopic borderline where the liquid turns to solid. The first mechanism is simply called particle pushing.
It's a microplow.
Exactly.
Like a snowplow moving down a street.
Yeah.
The inclusions can't outrun the plow. It can't float away. So as the advancing freezing front violently moves forward, it physically shoves the snow ahead of it. It pushes the snow outward until it finally gets trapped in the gutters and the curbs, which in our microscopic world are the crevices and boundaries between the growing metal crystals.
That analogy perfectly describes the physical forces at play. The solid-liquid interface literally exerts a short-range repulsive force on the particles. It sweeps them forward and sideways into the intercellular spaces until they are finally pinched and trapped by the converging solid grains.
Wow.
But there is a second, even more complex, fluid dynamics mechanism at play called the Marangoni effect.
The Marangoni effect? How does that operate?
It is driven by surface tension gradients. To visualize it, imagine dropping a tiny speck of liquid soap into a bowl of water that has black pepper sprinkled on top.
Oh yeah, the pepper violently shoots to the outer edges of the bowl.
Exactly, because the soap changes the surface tension of the water in that specific spot. The molten steel does the exact same thing at a microscopic level.
So wait, what is acting as the soap in the liquid steel?
Surface active elements like oxygen and sulfur.
Okay.
The concentration of these elements isn't perfectly uniform, especially right near the freezing interface where temperature gradients are extreme. This creates a gradient of interfacial tension. the liquid metal is being pulled more strongly in some directions than others. This tension gradient creates a literal microscopic fluid current, a physical river at the boundary layer that rapidly sweeps these particles directly into the boundary lines between the growing grains just before they freeze.
So it's a combination of being physically bulldozed by the growing crystals and being violently swept away by a microscopic river created by surface tension.
Great.
No wonder they end up densely clustered at the boundaries. The fundamental physics of the molten pool practically guarantee it.
Whether driven primarily by particle pushing or Marangoni convection, the result is identical. The distribution of inclusions is definitively non-uniform, driven by incredibly powerful physical forces at the solid-liquid interface.
Man, this has been such a journey. I mean, we started with massive steel bridges and worked our way down to microscopic particles being bulldozed by freezing metal at 3,000 degrees. So what does this all mean? Why did Sugden and Padacia's deep dive into these microscopic snowplows matter to the listener driving over that bridge?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it fundamentally changes how we manufacture the modern world.
Yeah.
Before this atomic-level understanding, welding was much more empirical. It was trial and error, relying on vast safety margins, and just hoping the inevitable impurities didn't ruin the joint.
Crossing our fingers.
Exactly. But by proving that we can predict exactly where inclusions will go, based on the first phase to solidify, metallurgical engineers gained an unprecedented level of predictive control.
Right.
They can specifically design welding consumables, like the medium carbon electrode used in Weld 2, to intentionally force a delta ferrite solidification.
Mm.
They can choreograph the exact placement of these microscopic impurities, trapping them safely inside the grain cores to nucleate acicular ferrite, ensuring that the joints holding our infrastructure together are profoundly resilient.
It's a beautiful realization. We spend so much time in our modern world thinking about impurities and flaws as things that need to be completely eradicated. We strive for pure data, pure elements, pure systems. But the secret to the strongest steel joints holding our literal world together isn't total absolute purity. It is learning how to choreograph the imperfections. It's taking the inevitable flaws of a chaotic system and engineering the environment so they are placed exactly where they need to be to make the entire structure stronger.
Right.
It makes you wonder what other systems in our lives or in the natural world around us might actually rely on flaws being perfectly positioned to function correctly. What if the noise we are trying so desperately to filter out is exactly the anchor we need to build resilience?
Yeah, that is a really profound lens through which to view complex systems. It is an engineering principle that translates remarkably well to human environments.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We loved unpacking this microscopic world with you, and we hope you never look at a steel structure exactly the same way again.
Thank you for joining the discussion. Keep looking closer at the structures around you.
We will see you on the next deep dive.